This is Evolutionary Radio. This is your host, Trevor Caritzen. We are coming at you live from the Evolutionary Radio headquarters. As always, my co-host, Steve Smee, is joining me.
Hey, what's up?
We also got the Mason, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm good. Glad to be back. I had a little break. I like to take these breaks once in a while. It just gets me refreshed, so I'm ready to go.
I'm guessing it was kid stuff.
It's always kid stuff, man. It's these little mini vacations, and baseball's in full swing now. It never ends.
See, I'm single and Steve has a cat. So that's why we're always recording. So Steve, do you want to go ahead and introduce topic number one?
Yeah, actually, I adopted a goat the other day as well. So I also have a pet goat now.
You seriously have a goat?
Yeah, I'm milking the goat. Gotta get those gains. Milking the goat.
Baby. Are you joking or like for real?
No, I'm joking. You can't have a goat where I live.
Yeah, I didn't think that was legal. You can actually own chickens though.
Not where I live, no. Where you live, you can own anything. You live
in Winnipeg, you can have up to 10 chickens in a residential area.
Because you guys are a bunch of hicks over there.
I would check your laws, man. You might be able to have chickens.
No, you can't. I know that. I think my HOA would get pissed.
I was thinking about it. Like, think about how sick that would be, waking up to, like, fresh eggs every morning.
Yeah, try it. Get some chickens. You can snuggle with them at night as well.
I don't think they would snuggle too well.
All right, so we like to do a relationship topic to start. So let me ask you first, Trevor. Matt's married, so this is going to be easy for him. But let me ask you, since you're young, and a lot of young guys, they fuck up relationships because, you know, they don't really know what they're doing, you know? And I look back at some of my past relationships, and I'm like, wow, I was an idiot. So since you're a lot younger than both me or Matt, I'm curious to hear your answer on this. What is a regret you've had from prior relationships that you look back and kind of kick yourself for?
Okay, so mine is a regret now, but I didn't regret it at the time. When I was younger, my sole focus in life was winning a pro card in bodybuilding. Like that's all I cared about. And I lost a lot of relationships with really good girls who I look them up now and, you know, they're all doing really well. One of them who I used to date, she's in med school. Another one just finished law school. They basically broke up with me because I put the gym before them. Like, so looking back now, I'm like, wow, I was an idiot. Like, I put the gym, which is always going to be there, over this woman who could potentially have been, you know, a great wife for me. But I don't know, like, I wouldn't be where I am today hadn't I done that. So I'm not sure, like, Steve, like, it's kind of like, it's a tough topic to discuss because I kind of think everything happened.
Well, let me ask you this before I let Matt chime in. What is something you did that you regret, like specifically, instead of saying, oh, you know, I didn't put her first. I mean, we get it. What is something specifically in the relationship? An example would be, you know, you hit her or something, like something specific that you did.
I'm pretty mellow, man. I've never hit a girlfriend.
I know, I'm just giving you an example, but like, what's something, did you say something you regret, like out of, you didn't mean, and then like, what's something you regret?
I don't really have any regrets. I'm like, this is just how we are in Canada, man. We don't really like do anything like that. Like, I've never hit a woman. I mean, I've said hurtful things, but
So what'd you say that was hurtful? And I'll let Matt come in on that.
No, but it was nothing like deceitful. It was, I just would always be honest, you know, if she asked me, do you think this looks good? And I didn't, I would tell her, no, I think you look better in other colors or something like that. Like, I don't really have any regrets to be honest. Let's see what the other Canadian says. Matt, do you have any regrets when it comes to relationships? I don't really have any.
Yeah, I have a few. some of them were when I was in the US, so I'll full disclosure here. but so I have no regrets, say, up to the age of 19. I did stupid shit that you wouldn't believe if I told you, unless you thought it was either in some crazy movie or just completely made up. Like, insane stuff. I don't regret any of that because nobody got hurt. I had fun. I got it all out of my system, over and done with. What I do regret is the girl that I was with, the last, like, I guess, long-term girlfriend I had before I met my wife, I cheated on her. And I think that's probably the worst thing, one of the worst things a human can do to somebody else. It's terrible. It's probably the one thing I'm most ashamed of in my life. And the reason I did it is flat out because I was being a pussy about it. We'd been together a couple years and I knew I didn't want to be with her forever, but I was living on campus. So to me, instead of dealing with it and facing the facts and talking to her and ending it, I just figured, well, I'll just go out with my buddies and bang some other chicks. So that's the one thing that, you know, I look back and think, man, that was like something really, really bad to do to another person. Cause I would be so hurt if I found out like that my wife cheated on me. Like it's basically the worst thing you could do in a relationship other than, you know, physically hurting the person. So that's really big. And then it's actually a funny topic because one thing I was actually discussing this with my wife about a week ago, and we were talking about like our kids are getting older. So just for an idea, we're both 35 and my kids are 9 and 10. My 10-year-old, his birthday is actually just next week. So he's almost 11. So if you think about it, we had kids pretty young compared to most people now, I think. And there's good and bad to it. It's not that I regret doing that. We actually had our first kid when we were both 21. I won't get into that whole story. I mean, I've kind of been through it before, the one that passed away. But so we were 21 when we first, you know, owned a house, had kids. So like everything was at super high speed. And the thing that caused in our relationship was we didn't get to be friends long enough. You know, like we were friends for a short time and then it was like, boom, 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 got married, then kid, 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 kid. And here we are at 35, all of a sudden it's like, you know, we kind of look back and we were saying, you know, I wish we would have had more time together, just the two of us. But then looking ahead, we'll get that on the back end. Because, I mean, my 11-year-old, and hopefully 10, 12, 13 years, he'll be out of the house. So now, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, free and clear of basically kids. So I'll have from then on, where a lot of people I know that have kids older, you know, they're going to have kids at home. They're raising younger kids still. We have a cousin that she's due to have a baby in June, and she's almost 40. So I'm like, man, you're going to be 60 and your kid's going to be 20, still probably living at home. So it's not that we regret doing it that way because, you know, we're still together. We have what we have because of what we did. And I wouldn't trade what I have for anything. But that was the one thing we missed was, you know, really getting to just have our time together, the two of us, you know, in our 20s, doing whatever we wanted, hanging out as friends and that kind. So those are all my regrets all rolled into one long rant.
Steve, what are your regrets? I'm curious.
Yeah, I think Trevor, maybe you're not understanding the question. So let me kind of maybe, or maybe you just haven't had relationships, but I've been in through a lot of relationships. The girls that I've actually lived with, those have been the major relationships. The first relationship that I had where I actually lived with someone, and it was my second or third long-term relationship. So my biggest regret in that one is lack of communication. And I should have did a better job on that. And she was, I was late 20s. She was mid 20s. And she was young too. So she was your age, Trevor. And that's something that she failed on as well. And I think that I would hope that she had learned from that. You know, this is like, 10, 15 years later. So I would think she would hopefully have learned from that as well. But there was definitely a lack of communication. There was things that I wasn't happy about that I didn't express to her, and everything she wasn't happy about that she didn't express to me. So it caused friction. And, even after we broke up, we never really sat down and talked about it. So it was kind of a weird situation. We kind of just kept what was bothering us a secret, you know, from the other person. That's a mistake. My second relationship, I actually lived with someone. My mistake, my regret in that one is not kind of asking her to marry me and not kind of planning a long-term, future together. And I think that kind of pushed her away into thinking that this guy doesn't want to be with me long-term. So that was a major issue in the relationship. There's also a lack of an emotional connection. And that had a lot to do with my abrasive personality. And that kind of rubbed her the wrong way. So that's something that I had to work on, having a temper. You know, she didn't feel like she could talk to me about stuff and, kind of things like that. My third one, where I live with someone, the big regret on that one, and I feel really bad about it, but like right away there were red flags that I kind of just let go. The big red flag was that she still lived with an ex. And she also had an ex that had passed away that she was still in love with. I mean, she still had his clothes. She still had pictures of him. She just never was over it. So those are red flags that you should look for. My regret on that one is I let the relationship last so long. It lasted, 2 or 3 years, and it shouldn't have even lasted a day. Because once you notice those types of red flags, you have to move on. Because that person is not ready to truly be in a relationship. So don't ignore red flags in a relationship. It's very important. And learn to listen, communicate. And you have to guide the other person along, guide them along, because the other person might not know how to communicate either. So you can't depend on them knowing that. You have to kind of guide it along. So that's a good lesson for you, Trevor, being young. You really have to get some relationships under your belt to really learn how to grow as a person. So you have a successful relationship when you do eventually settle down with someone.
Okay, I actually have a regret. Do you guys remember Miss Muscate, Alyssa? She made a couple threads on Evo.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. She was a sweetheart. She wanted to help. She didn't really know anything about the forums or bodybuilding or anything, but she wanted to help. So one regret I have is I never wanted to sleep at her house because she had a dog and I'm allergic to dogs. And it wasn't like terrible, but I wouldn't feel good when I would be at her house for a long period of time because like all that dog hair and everything. And I know that always upset her because I would never sleep at her house. So one regret I have is not just sucking it up and taking some Benadryl or something like that. And I think that's part of the problem we get in being so health-minded individuals, is I was like, well, I don't want to trigger an autoimmune response. I don't want my allergies to flare up. Like, it's not healthy sleeping with dog hair. But at the same time, I had this person who really cared about me and she wanted me to stay over, and I never did. So I guess that's the one regret I have. We ended up breaking up, not because of that. She wanted to move to Vancouver to pursue acting, and I'm here in Winnipeg finishing up my master's. So we're just kind of in two different stages in our life. So we broke up on good terms, and we have nothing but nice things to say about her. With the relationship, you guys just have to be able to spend time with one another. So if you're at different paths in your life, it just doesn't work. So
that's 65% of people in their 20s have a pet dog or a cat. So Trevor, my advice is suck it up, because you're eliminating 2/3 of women.
Well, that's still 35%. That's still a lot of women, Steve.
Plus your other picky things that you're pretty much down to, like, 1% of women, because if you count up everything else.
Forget the health aspect. I'm thinking about, what else are you missing out by not sleeping over? You got to suck it up, buddy, for that at least.
Well, we'll discuss that off air. Steve, do you want to talk about topic number two?
So topic number two is a good one. We can kind of ping pong. And this is something that, something worth talking about, because I did see the story of Bill Belichick and Bill Parcells, and those are two of the best head coaches in NFL history. But the interesting thing about Bill Belichick, he's the coach of the New England Patriots, by the way. I know, Trevor, you don't follow football, but he's won 5-some Super Bowls, been to like 7 or 8 Super Bowls. I mean, possibly the best head coach in NFL history. He never played professional football, and when he first got the opportunity to coach in the NFL as an assistant, his players looked at him, they're like, man, who's this fucking idiot? This guy never played before. He's got no athleticism or nothing. Like, he's going to teach us. He ended up basically, after like the first game, the players realized, holy shit, we're actually out scheming our opponent. This guy actually is a fantastic coach. So they realized that awfully quick. So why is it, and then another example is hockey. This is one you guys will like, being Canadian. Wayne Gretzky, greatest hockey player of all time. He was a head coach in the NHL. His team finished, the highest they ever finished was 12th place in their conference, never made the playoffs. He had a losing record. Michael Jordan, greatest NBA player of all time, became a general manager in the NBA. His team sucked. I mean, they were among the worst teams year in and year out. No one would go to the games. So why is it in bodybuilding we expect, the coaches to, look a certain way, when in professional sports, most professional head coaches in the NFL never even played in the NFL or had successful careers? Super Bowl winning head coach last year of the Eagles, he was a backup third string quarterback his entire career. He couldn't even, the one year he did get an opportunity to start, he had two touchdowns and like 8 interceptions. He sucked. He was a horrible quarterback, but he's a Super Bowl winning head coach. So, this is the thing I want to kind of ping pong. Just because someone is like fucking a meathead and they can stick steroids up their ass and they have top 1% genetics doesn't mean they know what the fuck they're talking about. And the flip side of it, just because someone, has average genetics and don't look like a bodybuilder, professional bodybuilder, doesn't mean they can't be a great coach. And that is proof in any sport that we look at. So coaching and actually doing it are actually two different things. So I'm just want to ping pong this a little bit. Why is it like in bodybuilding, everyone thinks that, wow, that guy, he's a jock. He's 6'2", 260 pounds, 4% body fat. He must know what he's talking about. Let me look at, do his diet. Let me do his workouts and I will look just like him. Why do people think that? I'm curious what you guys think.
Okay, I'll go first, because I make my living coaching people. So I understand this topic inside and out firsthand. I think the problem is that for someone new to bodybuilding, they don't realize how much genetics play. So you know, they see a guy who's massive and they're like, oh, wow, this guy must know what he's doing. But they haven't realized how much of a role genetics play. It's only after you've been training for a couple of years, you've been doing everything right. You maybe have a couple workout buddies who are, you know, following the same workout you are, eating pretty much the same food, and they make 10 times better results you are, that you realize, you know, how much genetics play a role. So I think that's part of the reason. Second, I think that a coach should look good, but I mean, a good coach doesn't necessarily have to look like Ronnie Coleman. Myself, for example, I am a shitty pro bodybuilder. I will never step on the Mr. Olympia stage. I just don't even close to have what it takes. That being said, though, I think your coach should still look pretty good, because that shows that they're passionate about training, nutrition, things like that. Now, I mean, I don't have near the amount of muscle I once did, but I still, you know, look athletic. I'm fit. I look healthy. I look like an athlete. So I think that a coach should at least be decent. You know, like, I think, you know, a football coach should at least be a decent football player. I don't think he should necessarily be NFL quality, but I think, you know, he should be a decent football player. I think, you know, a hockey coach should maybe play, you know, men's league hockey or something, because that just shows that they're passionate about what they do. So I see both sides to it, but yeah, I agree with you. The guys who look the best aren't most likely going to be the best coaches, because they didn't have to go through the school of hard knocks to get where they're at. They probably had really good genetics. They responded really well to gear. Matt, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's funny with sports, because Steve brings up a great point. Most of the time, the players that do become successful coaches are either second, third string guys, or, you know, they were just okay. It's never the superstars, you know, that end up being the good coach. You look at right now, kind of around sports, top of mind is Steve Kerr. He's been a fantastic coach. Yeah, he's got great players too. But was Steve Kerr an amazing basketball player? No, he's a good player. He's a role player. Think of baseball. All the good coaches that come into baseball that were players seem to be catchers. And why is that? It's because you have to be a student of the game. You have to understand the game. And when you're back there as a catcher, you're calling the game, you know, for the pitcher. You're deciding, okay, what are we going to throw based on the situation in the game? Who's on base? What are the hitter's tendencies? So the count, there's so many different parts of the game, right? So you look at the catchers, you got, you know, as old as Joe Torre, who's, God, he's got to be close to 80. He was a catcher. Joe Girardi was manager of the Yankees and won World Series. I believe it was his first year. So there are some examples, but they're not usually top level guys. And I think that's because they're forced to understand the game rather than just play. You know, when you're those top level guys and you have those top genetics, you just do. You don't have to think. You know, we all know that guy in the gym that's got an amazing body. You know, he's huge and he's eating shit and it doesn't matter. And he still doesn't put fat on. So to him, he doesn't have to think or understand. He just does things because he responds to it. So I think it really comes down to understanding. If you, you know, are just a regular guy, but you put your time in and understanding everything about bodybuilding, you can be a great coach. Just because you look a certain way doesn't mean you necessarily know how to do it. You might be big because you have a coach yourself and he gives you a list and you just do what's on that list without thinking at all. You know, and then all of a sudden you just give that same list to the next guy. That doesn't mean you're a good coach. You know, and you look at bodybuilding. Anybody can do bodybuilding. All you have to do is have a gym membership and buy food. You know, you can learn to be a bodybuilder. So if you want to equate that to sports, you know, you're talking about the level coach of, you know, 6 and 7 year old kids. You know, they're just playing because it's fun and their parents signed them up for it. So it's kind of the same thing. When you get into those really, really high levels, you know, the Olympia guys, that's a completely different story. You know, they're going to have a whole other level of understanding, and there probably are going to be some guys that look pretty good at that level. But yeah, I, I, I completely agree with Steve's original point. I don't think you necessarily have to be a meathead or look like that to be a good coach. But I also agree with Trevor that you should have some, you know, respect for what you do and not look like a slob. You know, you should have some idea of fitness and, you know, being at least healthy and in shape.
Steve, you got anything to add or should I talk about topic three?
No, I think you both made some really good points on that for sure. And I would be very wary if I was going to, you know, hire a personal trainer or a coach and for any type of weight training who was overweight. That would tell me that they just simply don't have the discipline or, you know, they don't have the willpower to eat correctly. So that would be a red flag for me. So at least like look good, you know, but I'm not saying that you need to look like a IFBB pro, you know, so you guys make some really good points.
That's the point I was trying to get across is they should look good. They don't have to necessarily be, you know, pro quality physique, but then you'll at least look good because then you can tell that they actually am passionate and live the lifestyle themselves.
Yeah. And then on the flip side, if they look like IFBB pros or they were IFBB pros, that doesn't make them a good coach. You know, that's totally not even relevant.
They could be a good coach or they could have just had really good parents. You really don't know. That's the problem. Okay, our third topic is steroids versus SARMs. So I had a listener email question asking about the SARM S23. And I basically replied to this guy. I said, S23 is so suppressive. It's just as suppressive as steroids. You might as well just use steroids. The whole benefit to SARMs is the fact that they're minimally suppressive. So if you're going to use something, if you're going to use the one SARM that's as suppressive as steroids, S23, you might as well just use steroids. So I thought a really good topic would be steroids versus SARMs. So Steve, you can go first, and then Matt, you go, and then I'll finish up. What are you guys' thoughts? You know, the pros and cons of each. Let's get into it.
Here's the thing, though, with S23, even though it's very, very strong, it's not going to be estrogenic and it's not going to be androgenic. So you're not getting those side effects. So that would be the benefit of a SARM over a steroid is that SARMs are selective. That's what the S stands for. Steroids are like dropping a fucking atomic bomb. And you know what I'm saying? And SARMs are more like a missile. You know, they're going to hit a direct target. So that would be the main benefit. I really feel like with SARMs, if you're in your 20s, you can run SARMs, you know, 12 weeks on, 12 weeks off, you know, maybe take 4 weeks, an extra 4 weeks off in between. And you can cycle SARMs, you know, 2, 3, maybe even 4 cycles of SARMs a year during your 20s. And then when you get to 30, you'll still have a decently healthy HPTA. But if you were to run steroids in your 20s and run 1, 2, maybe 3 cycles a year, I think by 30, for sure, you would have a damaged HPTA for sure. So the reproductive harm of running steroids versus SARMs is there. The estrogenic issues, like let's say you're prone to gynecomastia and you were to run a lot of aromatizing compounds, it's just going to be a matter of time until you get gyno. And we see this all the time. Like, you know, we have Boston Lawyer on our podcast. He had gyno surgery. You know, we have a moderator on our forums. He had gyno surgery, even though, you know, you take the, aromatase inhibitors to control your estrogen. Say you're extremely prone to it. It's going to be, like playing with fire. So eventually you're probably going to either need to run a very aggressive anti-gyno stack, which really, really sucks, or you're going to have surgery. So I think that would be the advantage of steroids versus SARMs. So I'd say if you're a guy in your 20s, you know, stick with SARMs. And then once you get older, then you can start gambling a little more with steroids. And plus, you know, with SARMs, there's a lot less in terms of, you know, ancillaries. Like, you don't need an AI. You don't need liver support. You don't need the supplementation. You don't need the drugs and PCT. So you save a lot of money just running SARMs versus steroids. So there's different advantages to both. And I think that if you treat this as a marathon and not a sprint, it makes a lot more sense to run SARMs your early years. I think, Trevor, in your situation, if you hadn't run SARMs even at 18, you'd probably still have a healthy HPTA now versus steroids.
Probably. So the reason why, you know, steroid usage is eventually going to cause gynecomastia, even if you use an AI, is because what an aromatase inhibitor does is it binds the aromatase enzyme and prevents testosterone from aromatizing into estrogen. The problem is that no AI is going to be able to bind to every single enzyme. It's going to bind to, you know, 99% of the enzymes, but there's still going to be a couple enzymes that it misses. It's like anything in life. Nothing's 100% efficient. So you're going to do one cycle, you're not going to notice anything, but you're going to get a small amount of gyno with each cycle you do. And eventually, if you do enough cycles, even if you're doing them responsibly with an AI, all the proper support supplements, that gyno is going to slowly build up and eventually you will need gyno surgery. Matt, go ahead and then I'll finish up this topic.
Yeah, I look at it a lot different now than I used to. I think maybe a couple years ago, I really used to compare them, kind of what we're talking about right now. But now I look at them as two completely different things. Kind of like when we get the question on the forums of what's better for me to use, creatine or BCAA? And we say, well, you know, like they're two completely different things. They'll do different things for you. I look at it the same way. And let me just give you an example. A lot of guys like to run Anavar, right? Really popular steroid, expensive. There's always the allure of it. And a lot of guys will start running it. And then they'll say, well, I got to up my dose to 70 milligrams a day, 80, 100 milligrams a day, because I'm not getting the gains that I wanted. Well, no shit. You're running Anavar. It's really mild. You're not supposed to get huge gains on it. So you need to have your expectations. So I think it depends what you want to do. And that's why I say they're different. If you want to run something that's way, way less suppressive, that's going to have zero to very, very minimal side effects, and you want to gain a couple pounds, whatever, then run SARMs. It's perfect for that. But if your goal is to, you know, be a power lifter and add a ton of strength, or, you know, you want to gain 10 pounds, or, you know, or you want it to be drastic, then you need to run steroids. You're not going to get that with SARMs. So they're not really comparable, you know, to me anymore. I just look at them in a different way. I think the only thing for me, it's at the age. If I had to say, you know, maybe 20 to 25, it's going to be SARMs every time if you can. If you have the discipline to just do it and not rush, perfect. Once you get past that 25, then, you know, start to look at if you want to go steroids or SARMs. And there's so much information out there. And you know what? It used to be different with sources. And it seems now it's kind of the same for both. There's just as many shitty steroid sources as there are SARM sources, you know? So you really have to do research, you know, when you decide to go with either one. And the way it's going, you know, in the U.S. right now with the laws, SARMs are going to be just as illegal as steroids soon. So, you know, it really is going to come down to you doing the research and comparing the two and deciding, you know, more or less what you want out of the cycle. So, but I think there's a place for both. And I think there's a place to run them both together, depending on your goals.
Yeah, like Matt said, it's kind of comparing apples to oranges. Like I said, you know, I train people for a living. I'm about 50-50 if I recommend SARMs or if I recommend steroids. You know, if I'm just training the average person, let's say they're an engineer, they're married, they have kids, they come to me, they say, hey, Trev, I'm looking to lose about 20 pounds. I might want to put on a little bit of muscle. I want to get a nice six pack. For someone like that, I would say, you know, steroids really aren't necessary. You know, all we need to do is get you on a proper diet. get you on a proper exercise program. If you want to take something, you could do a mild SARM cycle, but even then you really don't even need anything to reach your goals. So for someone like that, I would definitely say, you know, steroids aren't necessary. At the same time, if someone's hiring me for a bodybuilding contest prep, then, you know, then you're going to need to use steroids. So they're apples and oranges when it really comes down to it. Steroids are much stronger when it comes to terms like building muscle, increasing strength, increasing size. SARMs, though, they're kind of like steroids, side effect free younger brother. You know, they're not going to be near as good for building muscle or for building strength, but they're pretty much side effect free. They're much easier on your HPTA and they're way better for increasing endurance and fat loss. So our next topic is choosing the proper mattress. So this is something that has always blown my mind. You know, you'll see people driving a $80,000 Porsche and they're sleeping on a $150 mattress. You know, if you sleep 8 hours a night, that's a third of your life you're spending on this bed. So, I mean, it's really important. You should spend, you know, a decent amount of money on your mattress. The quality of your sleep is very important. I recently just replaced my mattress. I noticed that I was waking up a little bit more stiff, a little bit more achy. I kind of just assumed I was getting older. I assumed, you know, I'm so busy, I'm not taking care of myself as much as I should. My recovery isn't where it is. Since changing my mattress, it's been like a 180. So I've actually went and did a YouTube video with a mattress specialist. His name is Gary. He's owned the mattress store Mattress Source in Winnipeg for 25 years. So, I mean, this guy knows mattresses like the back of his hand. And he said about every 5 years, you should replace your mattress. And this is something fascinating I didn't know, is he said that there's different mattresses designed whether you sleep on your back, your side, or your stomach. So just like a woman needs to go to, you know, a running room and get a sports bra fitted for when she's doing running, you need to go to that mattress store and find a sales associate who's well-trained to fit a proper mattress for you depending on how you sleep. So I didn't know if you guys knew that. So that's basically the same thing. And then replacing your mattress every 5 years, I didn't know that rule. Matt and then Steve, did you guys know those two things? What are your thoughts about when it comes to buying a mattress?
So I didn't know that was kind of the general rule. I've been married 12 years and we are on our second mattress. So I kind of fall right into that range, but I'm telling you, it's a huge difference. Steve knows, we were talking recently. I do a lot of like little mini vacations with my kids. We'll just go away for 2-3 days at a time. And we were kind of joking about that I'm always out and about. And I can tell you that after sleeping 1 and 2 nights in a hotel, or even when I go away for work a couple days, I feel like I got hit by a truck. Like my body just exactly what Trevor just described. I feel achy. I feel like I'm getting old, which I am, but I feel like I'm getting old. I get home, my bed feels so good. I'm not sure if I have the right type for how I sleep. I never knew that was a thing. So when I go for the next one, that's definitely something I'll look into, but very interesting to hear that there's so much that goes into a mattress. And I'm not surprised that, you know, people don't pay attention to it. The great example with the Porsche, everybody wants to be flashy. You know, there's not a whole lot of people that, you know, friends and family that, you know, you show your mattress to, or they give a shit about it. So, you know, it's an easy one to be cheap on, but I mean, I bet you a good mattress, you know, now is probably $2,000-$3,000. You know, if I had to make a guess for something, you know, if you're actually going and getting the right thing, which if you look at how much time you spend on it and the benefits from it, it's nothing. You know, you should absolutely
get $1,000 will get you a very, very good mattress. Anything above that is just going to have extra cushion and things like that, but it's not actually a better mattress. For $500 to $1,000, that'll be like your Toyota Camry, like a solid, reliable, good quality mattress. Anything above that would kind of be like your Mercedes. It's going to look a little bit nicer. You know, it might feel a little bit softer, but it's not actually giving you any additional benefits.
So then there's absolutely no reason not to spend the money. to get a good mattress.
Yeah. So here's the thing with this, the every 5-year thing, it really depends on how you're treating your mattress. If your kids are like jumping up and down on the mattress, if you're like not rotating it, you're supposed to rotate your mattress every so often. If you're, you know, abusing it, whatever, then yeah, you might have to replace it every 5 years. But, you know, they kind of tell you that because they want you buying another mattress from them in another 5 years. So if you take care of your mattress the way you should, you use it just to sleep on, you don't like just lay on it just to read a book or lay on it to watch TV all day, your mattress should last you 10 years, maybe even 12 years. So, and also here's the thing, there's, you know, different prices of mattresses, but just because it's more expensive doesn't necessarily mean it's better. So this is my advice. You need to go to a good mattress place. You need to try their mattresses that they have, and you make sure that you're able to bring up the prices on your phone, because these places will match. They'll price match. So don't just go in there and buy whatever they want you to buy. Make sure you price match it and you get that price. Because there's some really, really good, you know, deals that you can find online, and they should match it. But I mean, basically there's three types of mattresses. You have the memory foam mattresses, which I do not recommend. And those are expensive. I mean, those are like $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. I do not recommend a memory foam mattress. Okay. That, and the reason for that, especially if you're a weightlifter, because we're muscular guys, we're bigger guys. And what's going to happen is your body's going to fight that mattress all night. So do not get a memory foam at all. Do not get a memory foam pillow either. A pillow is a very important thing to buy too. So you have three types of mattresses besides a memory foam. You have the firm, you have the soft, you have in between. If you're a back sleeper, then go more to the firm. If you're a side sleeper, then you want to go either in the middle or soft, you know, especially if you're a weightlifter, you have wide shoulders, because you're going to crunch yourself up at night. So, you know, that's my advice. And the mattress I bought cost close to $2,000, and I was able to, you know, have them price match it. And it was closer to $1,500 after the price match. The pillow I got cost about $120. And it's lasted me almost 2 years now. Very, very good quality. So don't go and buy like the My Pillow or, you know, some pillow off an infomercial or a pillow off Bed Bath, you know, from Bed Bath and Beyond or Walmart or something. You need to go to a good mattress place and have them help you pick out a good quality pillow. And it should cost between $100 and $150. And it should have a warranty, because that warranty is going to guarantee that that pillow lasts you for several years. But, you know, don't just worry about your mattress. You want to worry about your pillow as well. Very important.
I'm going to say two more things. Then, Matt, you can introduce topic number 5. So just like you rotate tires on your car, you should rotate your mattress every 6 months. The second thing is I bought a mattress that has an aloe vera I guess coating on the top of it. And what that does is it helps keep you cool. I didn't even know this was a thing until I was meeting with Gary and he asked me, you know, are you a relatively warm guy? Do you notice that you sweat a lot when you sleep? And I was like, yeah, why do you ask? He's like, well, you can actually get an aloe vera, I guess, insert on the foam of the mattress that'll cool you down. And it's really, really cool. Is when you lie on my mattress, it regulates your body temperature. It almost feels like you have like an air conditioner on you. Like it doesn't feel cold, but it absorbs the heat. So anyone who suffers from sweating during sleeping, next time you're buying a mattress, ask the sales associate if they have any mattress that has an aloe vera foam on it. Because I know that's a big problem for a lot of, you know, bigger, heavier guys, is that they really suffer from night sweats. So Matt, go ahead and introduce topic 5.
All right. We got a good question on PCT. This guy got absolutely destroyed for asking the question, but I think it's a fair question to ask. He just said, Is it important to use PCT drugs after completing a steroid cycle? Or can I just use things like vitamins, supplements, and food to recover? After all, food repairs the body. So you know what? It's a really good question because, I mean, Steve talks about this a lot. Everybody seems to be putting drugs into their body for every little thing. You know, a drug to counteract the other drug, to counteract the other drug. And we need drugs to stay awake. And then in the morning, we need drugs to wake up because we didn't get enough sleep. So it's kind of a whole, you know, chain. So I think this guy's trying to, you know, come up with the safest, healthiest way to PCT. So I think, you know, it's ideal to run the PCT drugs if you're going to run a steroid cycle. Can you run just things like vitamins? Sure, you can do whatever you want. I actually wrote this in the forums today. You can run no PCT if you want. You'll probably still recover fine, you know, but it's going to be a long recovery. You're going to feel like shit. You're probably going to lose all your gains. So I don't know why you'd want to do that. So I think, you know, that's kind of my concern here. He's going to come off. He's going to have a really rough landing. He's going to feel like shit. Are you going to stick to your diet, to your training? Likely not. So I think it's important to run the perfect PCT. We've gone through it in depth. It's in the stickies on the evolutionary.org forums. I think it's extremely important. But I like the guy at least asking the question because, I mean, some of you guys listening wouldn't believe if you're not on the forums every day, some of the PCTs that we see laid out and the dosages and the drugs and everything, it's absurd. So I'd honestly rather hear from somebody like this that's starting the natural route and saying kind of where do I go up from here instead of saying, hey, can I run 200 milligrams of Clomid my first few days into my PCT? So I don't know, Steve, what's your idea? You're pretty good with putting cycles and PCTs together.
Well, just to simplify things, and this is very, very important for people to understand this. And no matter how much I say this on the forums, 95% of guys don't listen or they keep believing some of the other bullshit on forums, but PCT does not help you recover. And that's something that a lot of guys don't understand when I say it because they don't understand the concept. They don't understand how the HPTA works. PCT gives you a soft landing when you come off steroids. Because when you come off steroids, your body's not producing hormones. So you crash when you come off. So if you didn't run a PCT, you just crash. You go from, you know, 100 miles an hour to 75 miles an hour to 50 miles an hour to 25 miles an hour to 0 miles an hour. You would just crash down to zero. And as the steroid esters are leaving your body, and you will feel it. After 5 or 6 weeks, once those esters are gone, you're going to feel like shit. So PCT helps give you a nice, smooth recovery. It's like jumping out of a building onto, you know, a trampoline or a mat or something, give you a nice, soft landing, or just jumping off, you know, a building and then landing on the concrete. Which one is better? So we do this, we get a soft landing so that we can keep our gains, stay motivated to go to the gym, keep our libido so we can bang our wives and girlfriends or husbands or boyfriends. And, you know, then once the PCT is through, then your body takes over and your body goes through a recovery phase. So that's the way it's done. You can't just magically just take a bunch of drugs and cure yourself. And you can't do what this guy thinks, which is just eat a bunch of food and vitamins and expect to recover either. So PCT is definitely something that, you know, we've learned about over the years. And that's why the perfect PCT protocol was put together. Although I don't 100%, you know, necessarily think that you need to follow that. It is a blueprint. Like for me, I run less of the SERMs that the perfect PCT has in it. And I run less of the AI that the perfect PCT has in it. Me personally, but it is a really good blueprint and you guys should really, really look at it and, you know, take a look at that and follow as as a blueprint.
I actually like this guy. I like how he's thinking. He's got the right idea that, you know, recovery isn't just about taking some drugs. You know, recovery is your sleep, your nutrition, stress. You know, like it has to do with everything. So I like that this guy is thinking outside of the box and thinking, you know, hey, a PCT isn't just taking some Clomid and Novadex. You know, it's also making sure I'm supplementing properly, taking the proper nutrients through food, making sure my rest, everything like that is good. However, it's not a question of what's necessary. It's a question of what's optimal. So ideally what you would do is run a really good PCT protocol, like the perfect PCT, and focus on taking the best quality supplements, focusing on having the best diet possible, minimizing stress. That's where you're going to recover the best. A lot of people misunderstand a PCT. They think it's recovery as like a light switch. Like, I run a PCT, oh, I'm recovered. Even with the best PCT protocol, recovery takes time. I always try to use this analogy. Recovery is like a dimmer switch. You know, once you've been using steroids for, let's say, 10, 12, 16 weeks, your natural testosterone production has been shut down for a long time. Restarting that is not going to restart overnight. It's going to take some time. It's kind of like once you boost a car, you want to let it run for a little bit before you actually have to drive it. So it's the same thing. You know, recovery just takes time. So after your PCT, you're not recovered. Your body is then going to take over, and it's still going to take, you know, probably 2 to 3 months after PCT to be fully recovered. And that's why we always tell people, run your cycle, run your PCT, and then take time off before you run your next cycle. Your time off doesn't actually start until you're done your PCT. A big misconception is that people think, oh, I did this 6-week PCT. I've been off for 6 weeks. No. The recovery process doesn't actually start until you finish your PCT. Matt, do you want to go ahead and introduce topic number 6? Sorry, I got a phone call. I was a little bit distracted there.
Yeah, the next one's really cool. Steve, we're kind of the same age, so we grew up when pro hormones were still available at the supplement store, and they were huge. And I know I used quite a few of them. So it was an email I got from a guy over in the UK. And apparently, I don't know all the laws, but apparently a lot of these pro hormones, they're still legal there. And he was asking if we could talk about if we had access to the old ones that were legit, because he does, what would we use? You know, would we recommend them? Is there a place for them in a steroid cycle, or just kind of what we think about it? So I picked out 3 that I used, and there's kind of the good, the middle, and the bad for me. One I would never ever use again, and I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, is M1T, which is methyl 1 testosterone. It is the most toxic thing I have ever put in my body. It was horrible. I think I ran a dose of like 10 milligrams per day, and I felt like death. I wanted to go to sleep. I couldn't train. It kind of reminds me of how guys say they feel when they run DNP. Like, I just felt so horrible. It's extremely potent. It's just terrible. I would never recommend it to anybody. The middle for me would be Superdrol. So it's still extremely popular. A lot of steroid sources will sell it because there is demand for it. This was kind of the middle ground for me. I did enjoy it, but I did have those times where I felt lethargic and a bit off. So it kind of had a bit of both, but I like it because it's dry. And it was something noticeable. The problem for me is that I was pretty young when I was doing these things. So, you know, it wasn't ideal to do it. I wouldn't recommend, you know, late teens doing these things. But again, it's toxic, right? These things are very liver toxic. They have a lot of side effects. So that's what I would really stress to this guy. And the one that this one's going to get a reaction completely opposite ways. there's a moderator in our forums who hates this compound, and there's other guys that love it, and that's apistate. Another one that you can still get from, you know, some underground labs. This one was fine for me. I actually really enjoyed it. I think I was 19, so maybe I would have got those gains anyways at the time. I really don't know. But I felt really good, didn't have that toxic, tired feeling. It was really good, like a nice hard look I had. I felt great. It kind of reminds me of like if a really lean guy was going to run Winstrol, his body would respond really well to it. And that's kind of how I felt when I ran that. So that's kind of the good, the bad, the ugly on pro hormones. If I had to make a recommendation, I'd tell the guy, you know, there's better options now. I wouldn't go back if I didn't have to. I'd advance to the future. I'd stick to steroids or SARMs, depending on, you know, all the other factors. But I don't know. Have you guys ever, you know, used any of these old ones? I know, Steve, you probably had access to a lot more. Trevor, you probably didn't even bother with them, I'm guessing.
It was pretty much before my time, to be honest. Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there used to be, you know, very easy to acquire these pro hormones and, you know, even like these clones, like these designer steroids like Superdrol, which is you know, designer steroid. It's basically a clone of Superdrol, which is an actual anabolic steroid. So it's pretty scary that these things were available just like on the internet. But if you go now and you try to find a pro hormone, what they're using now is a bunch of things like caffeine and supplements and, you know, they're using vitamins and minerals and stuff and Uva Ursi and stuff like that. And then they'll add in 1-DHEA, which is like a pre-pro hormone, very, very weak. And that's like the one thing that's still available that's decently strong. So, you know, I won't even waste any of my money on these that are being sold. You might as well just use SARMs, which are going to be safer. And then, or just go ahead and use anabolic steroids. So it's not even worth it anymore. And, I'm just kind of, you know, we look back, I've used them all. I used, all these clones and designer steroids of the time. And, you know, they were really, really toxic and really, really powerful. And, you know, I couldn't stand them. I mean, the side effects were just, ugh, you know, so I'd rather use, you know, SARMs or anabolic steroids personally.
So if you live in the United States or Canada, all pro hormones are now illegal after the 2014 pro hormone ban. So you wouldn't even be able to get them anyways, unless you're getting them from an underground lab. Like Steve said, some supplement companies are selling like natural testosterone boosters and calling it like Halovar or M1T or things like that, but they're just trying to trick naive buyers. You cannot legally buy pro hormones anymore. The only way you can get them is through an underground lab. The only pro hormones that are legal to purchase are DHEA and DHEA derivatives. The problem with DHEA is DHEA is the persecutor to all sex hormones. So that means testosterone, that also means estrogen, progesterone, things that you don't necessarily want to increase. So there are much, much better options than DHEA. It's kind of like buying, I can't believe it's not butter, or buying butter. Just buy the real thing. It's going to be way better. It's going to taste better. It's going to be healthier for you. I can't believe it's not butter is just hydrogenated trans fats that you don't want to be putting in your body. Same thing with pro hormones. They are extremely toxic. They are horrible for your hairline. They provide very little in the way of keepable gains. You'd be much better off just using steroids. For your host, Trevor Caritson, for my co-host, Steve Smee, and Matt, who is known on the evolutionary.org forums as Masonic Bodybuilder, this has been another episode of Evolutionary Radio. Live your life, look good doing it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.